This is a National Arts Center podcast. Find more great NAC podcasts on the performing arts at nacpodcast.ca or search on National Arts Center on iTunes and subscribe for free.
Hello and welcome to the Hexagon Studio. This is Marjolaine Fournier and I'm sitting with Jean-Jacques Van Blasler, and I'm quickly going through presentations because I can't wait to talk about my favorite piece in the whole world, the piece that I want played at my funeral, whether it's tomorrow or in 100 years, the Fauré Requiem. And it's a short piece, but it's immense. It's a huge piece in its content, in its message. Jean-Jacques, hello, and by what will we begin?
Well, let's say first that we want to know who Gabriel Fauré is, because many people don't know him, the piece is tied to the time he was living, the period he was living, which was from, about 1845 till, from 1845 exactly, till 1924. When he was born, Brahms was 12 years old, and Beethoven had been dead for 18 years. So this is, he really is in that great classical period, and he will be somebody who will be a very, in a way, a very classical composer. He will be very, follow the very Germanic style in formally. But he will create his very much own language. So that period, he in 1845, he's a son of a teacher. At 9 years old, they discover he has this incredible musical quality in him and send him to the famous school in Paris at that time, a private school called the Niedermeyer School. He will leave his family. He will be very much on his own from that point. He'll do some mediocre studies in the very beginning until he meets a very important composer in the French repertoire, Camille Saint-Saëns. And Camille Saint-Saëns, who's young still at that time, is a brilliant piano teacher, will reveal to him the new worlds. That means the new world: Schumann, Franz Liszt, Richard Wagner. And they will travel together even to Munich to go and listen to the Ring Cycle at the given moment. So he will be influenced, yes, and yes and no. He will have, and I have already spoken about that for a few seconds, he will have his own style. He will have his own style. It's very interesting because he will have great influence immediately on a certain number of students. He'll have influence Debussy's music. He will influence Ravel's music. Ravel will be one of his students. Georges Enesco will be another of his students. Florent Schmitt will be a student. Nadia Boulanger. Now, if you know that Nadia Boulanger at a given moment will be one of his students, and she will be the teacher of most of the composers of the 20th century, you can see there is that filiation, that follow-up from him to within this. And he himself will not have as such any following. His music is his music. He's an isolated figure. That's why I think he's not that very well known. But the music he has composed, and he hasn't composed many works. I mean, he's a great organist. He will be one of the great organists of the end of the 19th century with, you know, Bruckner, with Franz Liszt, César Franck. He will be the organist of those great Parisian churches called Saint-Sulpice and La Madeleine. He's on his own, and he will be so much on his own that at the end of his, because at the end of his life, he will be absolutely deaf, and he will turn within his own world. Now, speaking about his own world, in his career, between, you know, the 1860s when he starts composing until 1924, there are three major periods. And the first period is a salon period. It's a very charming pieces. I mean, very great. And he's reduced to that very much. And many of the pieces people know, small pieces for piano, came from that period and are still played by amateurs and by professional pianists, obviously. But by 1883, he gets married, and I think it's the beginning of his great period of maturity. 83 till he becomes deaf, 1903, will be the great period of better known pieces, in which also, of course, the Requiem will be part of. After that, he will compose and disappear within his own world, and he writes masterworks, quintets, and the string quartet at the end, which is his last work, is an absolutely marvelous piece, in which he does all kinds of harmonic things, and there will be very new things, and people will say, well, he didn't hear anymore what he was composing. I do think it is an absolutely marvelous work, and I do think that composers who are deaf hear the music inside and translate it.
There is something that I read. I didn't know he became deaf later on.
1903, yes.
But what I read, which I find terrifying as an idea, is that not only was, you know, you think deafness is sort of the volume being turned down, but also the pitches were getting distorted. And what I mean by that is that if you play a C, you expect to hear a C. Mm-hmm. But he would play a C down low, and he would hear, his ear would pick up an E.
Yeah.
And then at the top, it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. The pitch would be lower. He'd hear a lower pitch than what mm-hmm. he was playing. That must be crazy making.
And at that time, he will create very much, and much more than in the precedent periods, his own syntax, of course, and his own, and he will disappear within his own world very much. Mm. But still, those works are remarkable works.
Yeah, and for having heard his music without knowing of all these auditory troubles, mm-hmm. they're fantastic.
Oh, they are.
I accept them completely with all my heart, you know.
But already in that middle period in which the Requiem is part of, you have the indecision between tonal and modal, and very subtle variations of color, and a kind of dramatization created from what we call in French clair-obscur. And which is sort of, you know, so you have the darkness and the light, and he already plays very much around with that, next to the indecision between the tonal and the modal. Mm. Well, this being said, he develops his own language, and there is an opening up in that period, that middle period of the orchestral colors, which we will find also in the Requiem Mass.
What I read, I actually, this is something that I find fascinating. As important as Fauré was to the world of music and composers that followed him, I only got my hands on one single book about him. Mm-hmm. And in this book, they described his formation. And what's a little bit different about Fauré and maybe made it a little bit difficult for him to get the official teaching positions at the Conservatoire is he didn't go to the Conservatoire. He went to this Niedermeyer school basically because his tuition would be almost fully paid. And in this school, and I don't know if you agree, if this is if I'm reading too much into it, but in this school, every day they sang. They had a choir and they sang very modal things, very old music. Yes.
They're very much into Renaissance music also.
Yes. And so these very modal sounds that you hear in Fauré and the sound, well, Fauré is very soft, but there's a squareness sometimes that he mixes in that's beautiful, but you can only, your ear totally takes you back to these modal forms of music. Mm-hmm. But so his schooling was very different from any other musician in France.
It's not that it was not the traditional way of getting into it, and then later when he was composing, even in the second period, he was very much an administrator. I mean, he was inspector of music. He was doing all that, and I think it's unfortunate that he did that much administration, because I do think we could have had many more great pieces of music.
Well, that's a good point.
He hasn't composed that much, and he has composed in essentially for the piano and essentially chamber music. There are not many large, and there are no symphonies at all. But then the symphonies was the world of the Germanic world at that time. You know, you have Brahms, then you have Mahler and Bruckner, and in the French world, the symphonies disappeared very quickly.
That's true.
He tried, César Franck, and then there were all kinds of other works. But anyhow, this being said, people say that he learned a lot from Mendelssohn, that he had learned a lot from Gounod, and yes. But I do think he was much closer to Brahms and to people of the end of that century. He resembles very much some of those extraordinary musicians at the end of the 1890s. And anyhow, he's also very much very close to poetry, and I do think that we should not forget that he would compose wonderful melodies on the poems of the end of the century, and the vocal element is very present in his work.
His writing for the voice, it's clearly he has listened a lot to the voice. And didn't he try to write music on the poetry of Verlaine, and wasn't it difficult to get to work with him.
Everything flees, everything passes, space effaces the noise. To fuir, to pass, l'espace efface le bruit. Of course, translations don't say what the melody of the poetry does. And we'll find that also in the Requiem. In the Requiem, his music is a slow forward wave of music that doesn't hang in on the meaning of each word and just gives this movement from darkness to light. So perhaps,
and he does it in a very short time. This is something else that we haven't, maybe I mentioned the fact that it's very short.
You see, in very short time, he just produced it. Mind you, he did it in two periods. I mean, first he composed the Requiem with five of the elements that will become seven elements 2 years later. So he hadn't composed in the first version the Offertorio and the Libera a Me. So that will come 2 years later, and it will be premiered in the year 1900. So around the period that also Debussy creates Pelléas et Mélisande. And I'm doing this, I'm saying this because I have an idea in the back of my mind. We will come back to that in a few seconds. So this music, this requiem is for me, an expression of things that float, things that hover, things that fly, things that dance lightly forwards. So that's the kind of, they're like clouds that tie and untie, that form and deform. They're like thoughts that just float forward. And I do think this is what is going to be the music. His music speaks in a low voice. His music speaks in tenderness. This whole work is a nocturne, the openness of the night. What does the night bring you? The night brings you the way you see, look at the stars, and the stars, the stars will bring you some light of the cosmos, and the work that he will compose is something that will take you away from this earth into the cosmos. It's very much like the end of that century. Mahler did the same thing. Mahler had the same kind of thoughts about what death meant. Before you were born, you come from the silence and from the cosmos, and you're the non-existence before the birth, and then you have the period of anguish, which is our world, anguish. But with Fauré, it will be a sweet anguish. It will be a calming anguish. It will be an internalized anguish that you will feel throughout the requiem. And then comes death, and then you get back into the silence and into emptiness and the cosmos, the openness. And so that's why the stars are important. So you have these stars. But these things all have to be said in a low voice. And in fact, Debussy says the same thing at the end of Pelléas et Mélisande. At the end of Pelléas et Mélisande, when Pelléas is ready to flow through that window she wants to be opened at the end of the opera, which meant death, of course. Arkel, the old king, says, please, talk with a low voice now. The human soul is very silent. And the music of the Requiem is like the language of the soul. And this is a silent requiem. It's a requiem that takes you into silence, not without having said exactly what the road would be about. And that road is wonderfully well designed from one movement to the other within the seven movements, finally, which he has created. So, not only King Arkel, but there is also in Shakespeare. I think there is at the end of the Romeo and Juliet, when Juliet is in the garden of the Capulets, that nocturnal garden. You're going to say, well, why is he going to Romeo and Juliet? Because Romeo and Juliet is about love, and it's about love and death. And the great loves are the loves that have been cut off by death. It's the great loves are those that have not been able to happen. the balcony scene is a very important scene because it is the symbol of not being able to reach each other. And then, of course, in Romeo and Juliet, it is real. They disappear both into death. So it's very much tied. And in that scene, she said, come, civil knight, their sober suited matron, all in black. Come, gentle knight, come, loving black-browed knight. She asks for the knight to come, and the knight, of course, will open to happiness, to the light of the day coming up, a sweet day coming up. So, that's what this Requiem is about, and we will go now throughout the Requiem, if you don't mind, go through those seven movements, so we can see how he has built this extraordinary masterwork of taking us from the dark night, but the sweet night, to the light of the cosmos.
If I may add, what's missing from this Requiem? Mm-hmm. What's missing is the fire and the brimstone that the Catholics expect to hear always. Mm-hmm. This is a comforting Requiem. It's saying death is a gentle liberation. It's not a precipitation into the fires of hell. It's not the anger of God who's watching all this and waiting to punish you. No, it's liberation, well-deserved.
Absolutely.
Gentle. And yep. So the flames aren't there. The bass part, the double bass part, is one that's not like any Requiem double bass part ever, because it's not that we're static. We move forward, but there's none of that power. Strong, huge music.
You know, Gab, his this Requiem comes from a nocturnal musician. I mean, you know, this is essentially that. It's a modest work. No, it's not a modest work. It's an enormous work. But the enormity comes from the modest part within us. For he composes the Mass of the Dead, which sets free from anxiety, of anger, of terror, and is far, far away from the fraternal affirmative Requiem by Mozart. It's far away from Berlioz's Fury. It's far away of the theatrical Verdian event. It is far away also of the pathetic, emotional, upsetting Dvorak Requiem. Far away of the metaphysical Protestant Brahms in his Deutsche Requiem. His Requiem, and you're so right, is fluid, serene. It's sweetly persuasive. It takes you with him. You are taken towards the light. You're taken towards the silence that goes together with death. But death is your friend. And it goes from that initial assertiveness of the introit. I know that perhaps we can go into the introit. I mean, it goes from that initial assertiveness. You know, it's a very solemn part, but it's not long. Just boom, introit, 6 minutes, almost 7 minutes for three parts of the traditional mass. Introit, Requiem Aeternam, and Kyrie, and in it he's going to take you from that very solid entrance. He's going to take you to the final elevation of In Paradisum, and it's a work of innocence and pity, tender, fraternal, and profound language. I mean, it is everything, and carried by modulating muted strings, you know. And so let me stay in the introit, that first part, and there already you can see that he's going to use the language from that very beginning into the Kyrie, which is clearer and clearer, more and more translucent. But the Kyrie, instead of being a very affirmative thing, is almost a peaceful meditation, and already very serene. And of course, it is necessary for him to go to use it, that kind of serenity, to go into the offertorio, which is the second part. An offertorio, which is in B minor, is you get into the nocturne. We have talked about the night. We have talked of the importance of the night, so you can see the light. So you can see the light of the stars, you can see the light of the cosmos. And so the nocturne is a nocturne for a soul. And it's like a profound lake in which later in the next piece you will have the Sanctus, see the reflection of the stars. I mean, this is something. And in which the soul of the one that listens, of course, because a piece of music is also made to be listened to. It's not only to say what it is going towards the other world, into the emptiness and into the silence, but it is what it's to be listened to, and so it takes your soul, because this is music of the soul rather than music of the theater.
Very much.
He takes you on the roads of the night, so that you get used to the night, and that opens up, and that's where the baritone comes in, and the baritone, which you have described already in a way, so a very peaceful, appeasing bass baritone, which is very important, which he asked to be like that anyhow, and then he gets into that Sanctus. Very short, 3 minutes and a bit. I mean, and in that Sanctus, which is the light of the stars, the starry night. So you remember that wonderful song about Van Gogh's painting about starry night. And well, this is the starry night, and it builds on a melody based on the suave arpeggios of the harps, and it is as if, you know, when you're walking at night and you can dream under the starlight. I mean, this is what it is, and those arpeggios are like the wings that take you further and further and further, and takes you to the Pied Jésus.
Yeah, and that Sanctus, what is remarkable is often composers use the Sanctus as punctuation almost. Sanctus, they hammer away at it. him, Fauré, he goes sanctus, sanctus, gently, gentle waves. And the music underneath the voices is also like this, gentle. That's, he takes out all the abrasives of
it's
the music.
Fluidity, you know. Yes. It's fluid.
To
and it are waves, but you know, continuous waves that take you
very
further
much.
And further.
And these waves in the previous movement with the
offertorio,
the O Domine, yeah, where that's the only movement that you hear some doubt, some question.
Of course.
Domine, what? Who are you? What is? What do you mean? What will happen? Little tensions musically, but never resolved. But now you're in the Pie Jesu, but very much there's questions. Then the Sanctus that's very appeasing and takes you into
and takes you straight into the Pie Jesu, and where the soprano comes in for her only intervention, and it's like in Berceuse, it's you know. There too, that is very appeasing. And in fact, what she does, it's a very simple thing. Gentle Lord Jesus, grant them rest, grant them eternal rest. It's appeasing. It's the opening. It's the preparation. It's the waiting room for the Agnus Dei that will be following. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is the turning point. It is the turning point, and I will. And it's not for nothing that he only gave the soprano one piece, and for me it's the turning point. Why? And I will tell you, my linguistic background makes me analyze the text naturally, and 8 times he talks about give them rest in the whole Requiem. Once in the beginning, of course, he has to announce what this work is about. Give them rest. And then the Pie Jesu comes in, and that's what she says. Gentle Lord Jesus, grant them rest. Grant them eternal rest. And then it will be repeated continuously throughout the next 1, 2, 3 movements. 7 times out of the 8 are in those 3 last movements. She tells them, okay, that is what this Requiem is about.
Rest. Peace.
Give us peace. Away from the anguish of the living. Death is our friend. It helps us get peace.
In fact, the premise of the whole thing is that God is merciful.
Yeah, yes. I'm not a great specialist in canonic law, and but
I don't know that Fauré was either.
Yes. It's not a worrying God at all, and we'll talk about that in a few seconds.
So
let's get into the Agnus Dei. So I said it was the waiting room. The Pie Jesu is the waiting room for the Agnus Dei, and we get out of the. Out of the flat, the notes that are in flat major, and we're getting into F major, clear F major, and that Agnus Dei is a beautiful pastoral expansion, in which life is, it's the positive side, I think, the very positive side. It's the last moment before we're taking out of this world. So the Agnus Dei, kind of nostalgic piece, very beautiful melody, and which opens up, like all the other ones, one after another, opens up to the Libera Me, free me, Libera Me. There, we will have once more, you know, the fervor, all fervor is comes together. But in it, it's a very small, a short piece again, and it, again, here comes in the baritone, and he's preparing, of course, the last piece, which is in Paradiso, in Paradise, which is the other side of the medal. So in the Agnus Dei, you still have an earthy part. In the Paradisum, which follows, is you have the external part, the road towards the emptiness,
and
the one that you cannot describe and that only music can describe. And how does he do it? How does he do it? In Paradisum, he detaches, he unlocks all the ties, unties all the attachments that we have to open through the music infinite space. And finally, we are delivered from the notion of time itself. And only music can do that, because music is the only competition of time. It is built of the same stuff time is made of. That's what the first opera was about. That's what most of the music pieces are about. That's what great musicians try to do when they interpret. That is to take you out of time. And the only way to take you out of time next to death is music. Music is the road to silence. Music only exists because of silence, like death only exists, life only exists because of death. What can we say more? This work does it.
Perfectly. And on that note, Jean-Jacques, we could discuss so many little details. And you've said it. Life, death, time, music.
And this is the work that tells us that.
Absolutely. A short, short, tiny little jewel of music, of life. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
This has been a National Arts Center podcast produced in Ottawa by NAC New Media. Send us your comments and questions. Email us at nacpodcasts@gmail.com. Visit the podcast section of the iTunes store, where you can rate and comment on this podcast. We love to hear from you. Remember, you can find more great NAC podcasts at nacpodcast.ca. Or search on National Arts Center on iTunes and subscribe for free. Until next time, goodbye from Canada's National Arts Center.